TJ Eisenhardt on himself was actually amazing, finishing fourth overall and just the 2 seconds off the podium. His ride on stage two was personally, I thought, brilliant, daring in that he even stuck it to the World Tour guys, Stettina at least, after he got caught. He later said actually he was trying to get rid of Stettina by tacking on the downhill into Breckenridge. So evidently TJ himself knew that Stettina didn't go downhill as well, or maybe he was one of those skinny climbers. He also said that he was going to go balls deep that day. What? Welcome to a special edition of the Between Two Wheels podcast. This is your host, Tyler Yonke. Today we're going to discuss the Colorado Classic, the UCI 2.HC stage race that took place August 10 through 13. There was a men's and women's race. The women's race got no TV coverage, and the men's race got barely any TV coverage due to the weather. I did see one tweet from one of the women racers that said, talking about the men's race and how it was basically only coverage via Twitter, that's how all women's races are covered typically. All joking aside, it would have been fun to see some of the women. We just did not. I don't know why they didn't cover any of the stages of the women's, but what would have happened was the women likely would have had coverage because of the weather, because they were racing beforehand, and the men wouldn't have. Well, anyway, let's get right to it. Not sure why the men's race had not such a weather issue, but perhaps this was an issue more of using the NBC Sports Gold Network rather than the Tour Tracker. The Tour Tracker, which has been a situation for the Tour of California, Utah, and U.S. Pro Cycling Classic previously. The excuse for not getting any coverage, as discussed on TV and throughout the internet, was Mother Nature had her way, and there really wasn't anything we could do or could have been done about it. It's just what happens in bike racing in the outdoors. Personally, I thought this excuse was kind of BS right away, just immediately, and especially since we've seen horrific weather elsewhere throughout the world for bike racing in general. I remember the Giro when the race was neutralized on a downhill, Nairo Quintana attacking away, even though some said it was a radio miscommunications failure. That was in 2014, and we saw it. Why did we see it happen? Because we actually had TV coverage of it. TV announcer Paul Sherwin during the Colorado Classic, he actually tried to curb this type of analysis that I'm making here by saying that the mountains in Colorado and the weather, the mountains are just bigger and more of a problem than in Europe. And I'm like, what? The Front Range of the Rockies are bigger than the Alps. They're bigger than the Pyrenees, the Dolomites of Europe. I mean, the worst TV attempted coverage was on Saturday when the race was mostly on the Front Range and not deep within the mountains of Colorado. Breckenridge, the second stage, had more coverage than Thursday, which was just a Denver race. And Saturday in Breck is on the Continental Divide. Literally, it's on the Continental Divide. So what of it? Well, I had an online conversation with a friend and former teammate still living in Boulder. And he's responsible for this type of TV stuff for another big Colorado event, the Boulder Boulder. This is a running race, a 10K classic. It's on Memorial Day each year. And it ends in Folsom Field, the football stadium. And it's quite a grand event and on the campus there at CU Boulder. It's a huge annual event and gets a big TV coverage locally. Anyway, my friend, I didn't get permission to use his name, but he told me that the TV issue with the Colorado Classic, as he sees it, was kind of archaic and bullcrap. He indicated they were using a completely different technology, which does away with the whole fixed wing aircraft situation, that they used that for the Boulder Boulder. He says the TV coverage disruption was entirely avoidable. Now, I can't verify how NBC contracted out the logistics, but I'm only doing this and commenting on it to point out a few things. One, this had to be expected. Contrary to TV announcer Christian Vandeveld's assessment that while he lived in Colorado, the bad weather didn't happen until 5 p.m. and so therefore the interruption we had was unforeseen. And the truth is the weather can't be held to a schedule and it always has a chance of coming in before 5 p.m. Why have the race end so late? The audience, what is the audience that they're catering to? I would imagine the international feed might be a good audience and most of the U.S. audience is used to watching races earlier in the day anyway. We get online at crazy hours in the morning during July to watch the tour, and we'll do so for a race in the U.S. as well. Utah started around 10 or so every morning. Plus, riding in Colorado, you're always taking a rain vest or gloves for this exact reason. That's just the way it is out there. So to plan for late day finishes when finishes was just inviting trouble. One caveat to this analysis that I'm making here, and there's always exceptions, is however the direction of the race was trying to go in combining a concert with the race and therefore creating a revenue stream of paying customers. So if you don't know, they had this whole Velorama issue thing going where they would have a concert after the race, kind of in conjunction with it. And then some downtown sections, because it was always a circuit, they were having to get into the concert, to get in to see some of the race, you paid a price and you got special seating. And basically they were trying to have a third type of revenue. And I think it's a great concept. So perhaps that, and some of the complaints were that the bike race would end and then the concert wasn't for many hours afterwards. So there was this lull. So maybe they were trying to push the race back as far as possible just so they could get it as close to the concert time. I'm not sure if this connection actually played a part to starting later or to coincide with the concert, but it very well could be the case. Just maybe start the concert earlier. People will party during the middle of the day anyway. Well, maybe not when it's raining, but in Colorado, middle of the day, see a bike race and a concert, likely it's going to happen. Secondly, I'm truly not unhappy about missing out on the coverage for myself. I mean, I'm interested in seeing the sport grow and keeping these races progressing rather than just falling apart. I'm not sure of the financial impact, however, of missing out on seeing the race, but it had to affect viewership and the sponsors' profits, I would imagine. Therefore, if there's any way possible to maximize the viewership, this should be taken into account. And for this race, that means a better analysis of the weather. Just ask anybody who rides their bike in Colorado, I guess not Christian Vandeveld, and they'll just let you know storms come in. They do. As a matter of fact, one of the racers on TV afterwards is like, oh, we're having a typical Colorado day. Typical Colorado day is gorgeous sunshine and then a lot of rain. Okay, yeah, number three. So yeah, I wanted to see the roads and the racing. That would have been great. Stage one was a visual treat. And then stage two's epic by TJ Eisenhart appeared to be one of the best rides of the year. Blanket maybe kind of similar to that of Floyd Landis on stage 17 of the Tour de France 2000. Oh, wait, no, I'm not implying anything about TJ here. I'm just saying it was a spectacular ride. But that Floyd stage of 17 was pretty intense to watch for its daring escape. And this was as well. Stage three, however, was also an epic ride with that gravel section, the descent in the rain. The worst stage to watch, other than seeing the cool sights of Washington Park in Denver, was stage four. Yet the cameras were able to capture it all. Stage four, that is. Thank God we got to see that. Okay, so lastly, we had a similar mix-up of teams from the Tour of Utah with the addition of Cannondale, Drapac, and Trek Segafredo, the World Tour teams. As I mentioned previous episode, Utah only had one World Tour team, BMC. And by the way, there's a correction on that podcast event. BMC did have a stage win. I meant to say they didn't win the race overall. There you go, Kurt. Okay, so I guess if you combine the Tour of Utah and the Colorado Classic, it was essentially like a 10-day stage race with like 3 days of rest in between. That's a pretty long haul for a race at elevation. The field limit was around 93 riders. Well, it was 93 riders, and each team comprised of just six riders in total. By contrast to Utah, which had eight-man teams. So you're obviously paring down the size of the teams, you're paring down the actual race distance. So contrasting the field size, the team size, the average length of each stage to the Tour, you can see that the Colorado Classic was set up from the gun for a go-from-the-gun type of event. It was harder to control with the smaller teams and the distance promoted early and often type of attacks, which was really played out in stage three. Okay, let's get to some highlights, to some results of the specific stages. Stage one, Colorado Springs, Garden of the Gods. I mentioned it previously. It's a 150-kilometer race, circuit. All these were ended up being circuit races, bar stage three, which was just basically one giant loop, and the other ones were repeated loops. Okay, so for much of the stage, we saw a breakaway. There was about five riders in the lead, hovering just about a minute. Then the weather changed. The plane was ordered to the ground, and the race went dark. I tuned to Twitter. Any other way I could do to try to see this race. We only saw the results of the field came through the town at each lap. The final sprint, which is pretty fast, was taken by John Murphy of Hallowescal Citadel, which is owned and managed by George Hincappy. Any result in this race from a domestic or continental squad is a big deal, and this was certainly a great way for Hallowescal to start out. The team was formed as a feeder type team and originally just had U23 riders. John Murphy is actually about 32, I believe. It's grown into a more diverse team with goals of the continental status and probably higher. But there's a reported budget of about $1 million a year, so they're punching way above their weight for this one for sure. Great result, and I imagine that they felt like no matter what happened in the rest of this race, it was kind of a win. They only brought one rider, which we'll talk about next, TJ Eisenhart, as a climber. Everyone else was kind of the sprinter types, and I think it kind of came back to bite them in a bit, being able to support him properly, but either way. Stage two was in Breckenridge. It was a circuit race, just 103 kilometers. So we're talking around, 60 miles. It was always going to be brutal, and everyone knew it coming in. While most of the races have a time cut provision based on the winner's time, a percentage that you have to finish the stage, this being a circuit, they didn't have a cutoff percentage, but they said you had to make at least 8 of the 10 total laps without being lapped by the leader. So for a circuit race that was taking around, 16, 18 minutes to complete for the leaders, except for the really fast last lap, having a lapped rider provision showed the fear this circuit garnered right from the start. Anyway, from the gun, we had stage one winning team, Jalisco Citadel, fired off immediately with potential race winner TJ Eisenhart. He joined forces with United Healthcare's Daniel Eaton. As the stage was just under 70 miles and the profile being all up or mostly down, I mean, there was hardly any flat except for when they'd come through the start-finish area. Staying away, it didn't seem likely, but it also didn't seem outrageous. Lap after lap, TJ held on the front, on the climb, and eventually dropping all of his breakaway mates. And Daniel Eaton, I think, got popped off around with 6 to go. So he was solo for like the last 3-4 laps. During the last two laps, the charge was on and Trek's Peter Stettina, along with Cannondale's Alex Howes, really made a move to get TJ. I think the climb was a little too short for Stettina, who's a more of a Grand Tour climber type, where Alex Howes, the climb was stretching him just a bit. So it was a good combo to have those two kind of joining forces, kind of a mix of I'm not quite good enough for this and this isn't quite my strength, and yet coming together, kind of pairing them as equals. Anyway, they caught TJ just as they crested the KOM on the bell lap, and it appeared like Pete or Alex would have this one because, you know, TJ's just been out there all day. However, TJ wasn't done, and he attacked on the wicked descent and actually distancing Stettina, who couldn't catch back up again. And Alex then took the sprint behind a chasing Sepp Kuss, who ended up rolling his tire and kind of missing out on a brilliant fourth. Instead, Manuel Seni, a BMC, rolled in for fourth, 36 seconds. From the lead. TJ had the overall lead, just missing the sprint there by up from Alex Howes, but just 1 second. Stettina then at 11 seconds. Seni at 32. Svechkov at 51 seconds, rounding out the top five. In stage three in Denver, it's 130 kilometers. It's kind of while Breckenridge was certainly exciting and kind of the epic one, this may actually be the killer stage here. It had two big climbs outside of Golden, and then there was some gravel as well. But this was the game changer for the race. And we only saw the final 300 meters of this race in general, with only 1 second separating first, which was TJ, and Howes second place. This expectation was for Howes to try to grab one of the two available sprint bonuses on the course. Sprint one was not available because as the field rolled through, there was already a sprint a group off the front. And so the sprint two loomed really large for this. They had two good climbs, and over the climbs, a group of about five formed. This is as I'm been reading after the fact, because obviously we didn't get to see this, you know, Twitter and what have you, kind of a seminal recap of what were going on. So Seni and Svechkov took to the helm, and soon only those two remained. Sergey Svechkov actually lives in that area, so he's pretty familiar with it. Matter of fact, he says he does his training there every day. And, Seni, just evidently he's been known for being a great defender. So it's wet, turns gravel, there's wetness. And anyway, they ripped the nasty downhill into Golden, gaining buckets of seconds and coming into the front range, Wheatland area, going into Denver with about a minute 20 on the field. There is a second sprint point available there, and with only those two out the front, Howes was able to get that second sprint, tying in for the overall GC lead. However, as he became the virtual leader of the day, and based on the placing of the prior day in Breckenridge, and all he had to do was get to the finish without losing his lead, and he'd be in the overall. Oh yeah, and catch those two blokes off the front. Svechkov being down 51 seconds, Sani being down 32, and with time bonuses at the finish, the sprint point number two along the way, he had his work cut out for him. Svechkov actually took the win over Sani in what appeared to be some sort of maybe pre-range deal, the way that Sani came around and kind of, you know, flicked him to just take it. This wasn't a bad thing, however. I mean, Sani needed to get the time away from the field to get the overall. He already had 20-plus seconds on Svechkov, and he needed Svechkov to make needed him to help make this happen by basically being a big power engine on the field on the break coming in. The field rolled in over a minute after that, and the GC lead then went to Sani, with second going to Svechkov and Howe as a distant third, and TJ Eisenhart just off the podium there at fourth. All I could say for that one is ouch for those guys. Stage four, Denver to Denver, is 120 kilometers. This stage was pretty, as it showcased downtown Denver, the zoo, the park, the sunny skies, but ultimately it was a real bore to watch, personally. The break was allowed some freedom, and then they reeled him in with one to go. The sprint was won by Israel Academy cycling Mikhail Ram, and there was an Italian, Marco Canole of Nippo Vino Fantini, who protested that he was pushed into the barriers. But while you look at it, though, it looks like the barriers actually themselves kind of stick out, and they impede Marco a little more than actually Ram does by taking any poor line. As this was a circuit race, the Italian sprinter, Marco, he had an opportunity, plenty of chances, to, every time he comes around, to check out the barriers, to check out how you're going to take this last sprint. You know, we do that as crit riders. You know, sometimes you're taking preems simply for the fact to see how you want this to set up for the finish. You know, you could have done this as well and noticed that this barrier, I mean, it was obvious that the barrier just kind of pops out in the road there. He didn't have to pick the barrier side to the sprint, and so his protest was kind of lame and ineffective anyway. Well, what about some talking points from the Colorado Classic? Interesting note, Cycling Tips reporter and former Velo News editor, blowhard, Neil Rogers tweeted after stage three, quote, spoke with Bookwalter, Stettina, Reinen. No one sure how two held off chase group. At least six pulling at 60 kilometers an hour for last 20K, unquote. Which Bookwalter then immediately responded to the tweet saying, quote, I never said that. Those guys were pulling like a bunch of skinny climbers and nursing through the wet corners, unquote. Others like Howes and Stettina did say they were flying and not catching up to the two up front. Some even wondered if there were some help from the motorbikes. But I think once the time gap was made on the downhill, combined with the tailwind, some luck, just gave the win to the lead too. But it is interesting to see the use of the word skinny climbers from a climber himself and used as a pejorative. It's a good time. The word from the other riders and TJ himself, TJ Eisenhart, was that TJ didn't help pull the break back. And personally, he shouldn't have. Howes of Cannondale Drapac had won the sprint, giving him the bonus, in which he had the World Tour team as well, and the teammates around him, while TJ was completely isolated. As I had mentioned earlier, TJ's team came there with basically a sprinter's team. He was the only climber of note. Something happened to Cannondale Drapac. I'm not sure what it was, but they let Sani get away in the first place. In addition, Trek needed to work also to give their guy Kiel Reinen a shot at winning the day. Once Stettina was no longer on the GC outlook because he could not get away when he had tried to attack on the climbs, and then once Sani was up the road, he no longer was really at play. So now it was up to Trek to try to bring it back for Reinen for the win. But Trek didn't have the power either. The point of all this is the smaller teams and the short stages, they just created a great venue that we got to see. Well, take that back, that we didn't get to see. TJ Eisenhart on himself was actually amazing, finishing fourth overall and just the 2 seconds off the podium. His ride on stage two was personally, I thought, brilliant, daring in that he even stuck it to the World Tour guys, Stettina at least, after he got caught. He later said actually he was trying to get rid of Stettina by tacking on the downhill into Breckenridge. So evidently TJ himself knew that Stettina didn't go downhill as well, or maybe he was one of those skinny climbers. He also said that he was going to go balls deep that day. What? That's quite a comment there. Anyway, my last comments on the 2017 Colorado Classic is, let's have more of this type of racing, but please let's get the TV chaos worked out. This type of racing, much like that Hammer series, we didn't get to talk about that, but that's an interesting thing in itself, is seemingly devised to give more entertaining TV product and to also to have fans and just see more of a continuous race by having the circuits themselves. So if it's devised to have more TV entertainment, devised to give the fans more of an audience and more excitement, so let's make sure that part of that equation, the TV audience, is at least good.